Morning. We welcome you all to our first set of February cases, but especially welcome students from the Lancaster High School. Would they please stand, Lancaster High School? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. And if they come, we send them materials about the case. They may engage in some outside activities relating to the case. They come and listen to an oral argument, and then the students meet with a justice assigned for the day to meet with students, and they discuss the procedures of the court in taking cases and deciding cases. The substantive issues of the cases are not discussed at these sessions, and everyone is invited to attend along with the students. If anyone would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. If not, we shall proceed, and I'll first introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser, with whom you'll meet after this case. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call the next case, which is 10-AP-1398-CR, State versus Tally Ann Rowan. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Rowan is Paul G. Lazat, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Lazat. I represent Tally Ann Rowan. On behalf of Ms. Rowan, I am asking this court to find that there was insufficient evidence to support her conviction for battery to a law enforcement officer. In short, at the moment Ms. Rowan injured Officer Jennifer Knutson, Officer Knutson was not acting in an official capacity, no matter how laudable her willingness to assist hospital staff in providing medical assistance to Ms. Rowan. If this court ultimately concludes that the evidence was sufficient to support that felony conviction, Ms. Rowan respectfully asked the court to rule that her circuit court imposed extended supervision condition is unreasonable and inappropriate and therefore unconstitutional under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution and, if need be, unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution. Regarding this case's circuit court-ordered extended supervision condition, that search condition virtually eliminates all of Ms. Rowan's privacy interests while she is on extended supervision. For that condition means that any time of the day or night, any law enforcement officer, whether a municipal police officer, a deputy sheriff, a state trooper, or an agent of the Division of Community Corrections, may conduct a suspicionless search of Ms. Rowan's person, her vehicles, and her residence. Thus, that condition grants general law enforcement officers unfettered discretion, for instance, not only to stop her car any time that she is driving and then conduct a search of her person in the passenger compartment of the car, but also to insist that she open the trunk of the vehicle and open any suitcases therein. So, for instance, if she was traveling to visit family, she would be subject to such a search.
Suppose they found drugs in the search during that search. Could they use that to convict her of another crime?
If her condition of extended supervision is upheld as constitutional and the police officer conducting the search is aware of the court-ordered extended supervision condition, I believe they could.
Mr. Lazat, I thought that when I looked at this case, that the restriction imposed by the judge was more restrictive than the condition that resulted in the U.S. Supreme Court case, the Sampson case. And the reason I say that is because here the search is supposed to be limited in the first instance to search for a gun. You don't have that kind of restriction in the statute involved in the Sampson case. Do you think that makes a difference?
I don't, Your Honor. With respect to a gun, a handgun is small enough that, in my view, as a practical matter, there would be no meaningful distinction. So, for instance, in my view, the way the circuit court judge crafted the condition, that condition would mean that whether the time of day is 2 p.m. or 2 a.m., a law enforcement officer could show up to Ms. Rowan's home and enter that home to conduct a search, presumably whether she's present or not. And then given the size of a handgun, that would enable that officer to go through every room, every closet, every drawer, every single container that would be large enough to conceal a small handgun. Therefore, that search condition, in my view, implicates the two chief evils the Fourth Amendment is meant to protect people against. One, providing police unbridled discretion to simply rummage through the personal effects of a person, and two, and perhaps more importantly, uncontrolled access to physically enter the home. Now, notwithstanding that many courts have interpreted Sampson versus California in a very broad fashion, Ms. Rowan does maintain that current Fourth Amendment jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court does not authorize this case as court-ordered search condition.
Well, suppose that instead of this condition, we eliminated the home, okay? And it just said that any law enforcement officer could search her for a weapon outside the home. I mean, that the point is her danger to someone else, right?
Pardon?
The point of this restriction is to eliminate her danger to someone else.
Correct.
Right? So suppose it was just outside the home that any law enforcement officer could search her with a car. How would that stand up?
That would be an improvement. In my opinion, that would be too broad. You know, for instance, it would allow a situation where she's in a restaurant eating dinner with her family, where any law enforcement officer could approach the table and insist that she stand up and be subjected to a Terry pat-down search. It would, in my view, allow the officer to insist that she hand over her purse and allow the officer to go through the purse.
We can handle that, too, because that may be an unreasonable application of the search. I mean, maybe you have to say, do you mind stepping outside with me, or let's go to the ladies' room or into the kitchen or wherever there would be some privacy?
That certainly would improve, in my view, the invasion of privacy and the embarrassment to her. However, as the condition is drafted right now, there is no such restriction on any police officer. The circuit court judge did say that any search must be performed in a reasonable manner. However, the particular example he gave at the circuit court level was to the effect that, for instance, officers could not enter her home and just simply tear the place apart. And I think, you know, many officers would view my example of the restaurant search as not unreasonable.
Is she entitled to a firearm under Wisconsin law?
As a convicted felon, she will not be able to possess
a
firearm.
So that any firearm would be unlawful?
Correct.
Let's say Ms. Whalen were the probation or parole officer. What would be the maximum power she would have without this condition?
Yeah. Agent of the Division of Community Corrections would be able to conduct a search of the home, for instance, just based on reasonable grounds to believe that the home contained any form of contraband, handgun or anything else that would constitute contraband. The rules applicable to the agent say prior to conducting a home search, they should obtain the approval of their supervisor. However, if exigent circumstances are present, such as a reasonable basis to conclude that the person under supervision would escape detection or destroy evidence, the agent can enter the home on his or her own.
How about a law enforcement officer?
Without this condition, a law enforcement officer, a general law enforcement officer, such as a deputy sheriff, would not be able to enter her home absent a judicial warrant or absent probable cause and exigent circumstances. I guess an example of that might be if the officer actually saw Ms. Roan in possession of a firearm outside the home and she fled into the home. It would be my understanding that the officer would have probable cause to believe that that's a felon in possession of a firearm and pursue her into the home.
This is from Pierce County?
It is.
Are there a lot of probation or parole officers in Pierce County?
I don't know the number that supervise that area.
Are parole officers law enforcement officers?
They are a law enforcement officer. It seems in the case law they make a distinction, some of the cases, between what they term a general law enforcement officer, which, as I understand, the cases are referring to municipal police officers, deputy sheriffs, and they categorize agents in a different, view them as a different category, where they're law enforcement, but they also are not in an entirely adversarial relationship with the person they supervise.
Well, in this case, would the parole officer be entitled to search anywhere at any time, or is that in conflict with the rules?
It's my understanding that the circuit court judge meant to grant that authority to agents. So, in other words, the agent would have greater discretion to engage in searches than would otherwise be afforded under the code.
So the trial court granted greater authority to a parole agent than the Department of Corrections, who's the employer, gives it.
That's my understanding, that was the intent.
Where does the court get that authority?
I'm unaware of any precise authority giving a circuit court judge that authority. I was always under the impression in my work as a public defender that a circuit court judge could craft conditions of supervision, whether it be probation or parole, that were more stringent than the conditions the code would apply to the typical person under supervision.
And I think, counsel, your last statement kind of underscores one of the more interesting questions that this case presents, which is what is the reasonable expectation of privacy of a parolee? You know, part of what we have to wrestle with is the language in Sampson. And I'm looking at the language where the court recited, as we noted in Knights, this is at the beginning of Section 3, parolees are on the continuum of state-imposed punishments. On this continuum, parolees have fewer expectations of privacy than probationers because parole is more akin to imprisonment than probation is to imprisonment. And as this court has pointed out, parole is an established variation on imprisonment of convicted criminals. The essence of parole is release from prison before the completion of sentence on the condition that the prisoner abides by certain rules during the balance of the sentence. Now, I agree with you when you observe that the court's order is likely to result or could very well result in invasions of privacy. The question, though, turns on whether, under the circumstances, that invasion is reasonable. Given the continuum that the court has set out, where would you urge us to draw the line?
Your Honor, I agree in the sense, I view it in my mind, there are four categories of persons. The person never convicted of a crime, the person on probation, the person on extended supervision or parole, and the person in prison. In terms of, it's my understanding in reading Sampson and the other Fourth Amendment case law, if you apply the general Fourth Amendment test that involves assessing the particular expectation of privacy against the government's need for the search it's advocating, because I understand it, you look not only at the individual's subjective expectation of privacy, but whether that particular expectation of privacy is one that society is prepared to recognize as legitimate. In reading Sampson versus California, it's my understanding that it was essentially a situation where the state of California was faced with a systemic-wide crisis, having over 130,000 parolees, the highest recidivism rate in the nation. And the people of California, which are as the community, the society, through their elected state representatives, decided that that was an expectation of privacy that could be curtailed given that state's extreme situation. If you don't measure the elimination of the expectation of privacy by whether it's an expectation of privacy that the community is prepared to recognize as legitimate, well, then any time a circuit court judge would say you're subject to these suspicionless searches, well, that would just simply eliminate.
But that's why I ask you what your view is of the distinction between the four categories. I mean, certainly inmates in a prison are subject to far more intrusive invasions of privacy than what's at issue here. But where is the distinction as it relates to your client in this matter?
Right. I think within the state of Wisconsin, if we look at the administrative code, you know, that gives an indication of our society, our state's recognition of the varying privacy interests. For instance, the administrative code section that applies to those that are incarcerated in state prison provides that their cells, which is the functional equivalent of their then residence, is subject to a search at any time for any reason by any staff member of the DOC, although it does provide that they should disturb their effects as little as possible and also prepare a written report recording the date and time and the nature of the search, what was found.
Looking at this, is it possible that the trial court was looking for the least, hang with me here, the least onerous way of fulfilling the function of sentencing? In other words, to protect the public, could the trial court have been considering a lengthier term of initial confinement, but then said, well, that might not be necessary so long as the proper safeguards are put in place, given the facts of this case, the threats to shoot law enforcement and others and to harm others? Could it be that, and what role should that play in our consideration of this matter?
Yeah, I think it could be, Your Honor. I don't recall him explicitly articulating that rationale, but it seems to me that it's certainly reasonable to think that could have been implicitly part of his thought process. And
should we consider that at all?
I don't think this court should assume that that was part of his thought process without him, you know, explicitly stating so. But you know, for what it's worth, it was clear to me that Judge Duvall was, you know, struggling very sincerely and earnestly in trying to come up with what he thought, you know, was the best solution in this circumstance.
Mr. Lazat, are we looking at this particular condition prematurely? In Sampson, as I understand it, there had been a search. And so when the U.S. Supreme Court was looking at the statutory limitation, he was looking at it within the framework of an actual search. Does that make a difference here?
It is a difference. The reason I think we should go forward with this case is, for instance, if this condition is left to stand, an officer could presumably enter her house several times, find no contraband that would lead to criminal charges and the suppression of evidence. So I think it would pose too great of a danger of her being exposed to repeated invasions of her privacy where there's no effective remedy in the sense of suppression of the evidence because no contraband is found.
In Oakley, did we look at the, can't remember exactly, did we look at the condition before it was enforced? That was the one, don't have any children.
Right, I'm aware of that case, and that is an instance that would strike me as the circuit court judge imposing a condition that was not explicitly authorized by the administrative court.
Right. are a couple of lines of cases here that are discussed. If we would adopt the Sampson approach that relied in part on the state statute, the state regulation, is there anything consistent with that analysis that would preclude the DOC from passing a regulation that would, in essence, eliminate those constitutional rights set forth in
If the Department of Corrections was pursuing administrative code sections that would be the functional equivalent of the state statute in California, I think that would necessarily lead to a number of legislative hearings and presentation of empirical evidence concerning whether such an expansive search doctrine was necessary. I think it would be much more of a full hearing where essentially the community would have input into whether that's the way the state of Wisconsin wants to run its extended supervision, probation supervision system.
If this language wasn't in the order at all, what kind of searches could occur with the agent being present, or if the agent wanted a law enforcement officer to go with the agent? Are there restrictions on how often the agent could show up at this person's house, or how often the agent could require them to come in and provide a sample, or what could be done without this language?
What strikes me that the code, and I'm looking at Administrative Code Section DOC 328.21, that it's actually quite flexible in the sense, you know, as I look at it right now, I don't see anything specifying restricting the number of times the agent could enter. You know, I see it clearly provides in subsection 3, the agent must have reasonable grounds to believe that contraband will be found with inside and should seek the supervisor's permission to enter the home, but if exigent circumstances require an immediate entry, that the agent may do so.
If the agent said, you know what, I want to come have a home visit today, see how you're doing. Or if the agent just knocks on the door and says, you know, I'd like to come in and talk to you. Can a person on probation or a person on extended supervision say, you know what, thanks, but no thanks?
They can literally say it, but I think they'd be putting themselves in danger of revocation. It's my understanding that's an approved supervision technique in our state, the agent making a random, unannounced home visit. And they're not, the code provides that the agent could not make a forced entry of the home if the client, they refer to as a client, was not there. But if the person ultimately is proving to be not amenable to supervision, just will not cooperate with the agent, then they'll be facing revocation.
Yes, I'm just trying to figure out what difference it makes that it's in the order.
The case law does seem to make a distinction between the purposes of the general law enforcement officer and the agent, that the role between the police officer and the person would be an adversarial one, and the agent role with respect to the person is not an entirely adversarial one, that it's viewed or at least hoped the agent is working with the person, trying to help that person reintegrate, help them with job, et cetera.
So to the extent that you quarrel with the language in the order, it's as it pertains to law enforcement's ability to conduct some sort of search?
Right. The position I've taken throughout and back in the circuit court was just asking the judge, I was willing to say, judge, if you want to impose conditions that are more stringent than the code, we're accepting that. What I am asking though, judge, is put some kind of restriction on there where there has to be some sort of objective basis. I thought it was going more than halfway in advocating, judge, will accept an ES condition where a police officer can enter her home based on reasonable suspicion that she possesses a firearm. That's a much greater curtailment of her privacy interests than anyone else I know of who's on any form of supervision in this state.
Counsel, DOC 328.21 provides that there can be a search by the agent if there are reasonable grounds to believe contraband is present. What, if any, difference is there in your mind, between reasonable grounds and reasonable grounds to believe and reasonable suspicion?
I'm actually assuming they're the same. It was made clear in State versus Griffith that the reasonable grounds referred to in the code is less than the probable cause necessary to obtain a warrant. It did not really specify within that opinion whether that reasonable grounds is the same as reasonable suspicion or somewhere in between reasonable suspicion and probable cause. The Iowa Supreme Court, in dealing with a similar issue, indicated in their opinion, which was decided based on the Iowa State Constitution, that in that court's view, reasonable suspicion is the lowest objective standard known to the law. And I'm unaware of any case that specifies whether this reasonable grounds within the code is exactly the same as reasonable suspicion or a slightly higher standard.
So this condition is different than our existing statutes or code in that it goes to law, it goes to the police officer as opposed to the probation agent, and that the condition doesn't require reasonable suspicion or has no standard. In fact, it says without reasonable suspicion, as opposed to, for instance, DOC needing reasonable grounds to believe, which is tantamount to reasonable suspicion.
Correct. It would give a general law enforcement officer even more authority to conduct a search than the code currently gives an agent. As I understood the judge's intent, he did mean that a police officer could stop her car any time the officer sees it and then conduct a search throughout the vehicle, including the trunk and any closed containers within the car. He did mean that a police officer could enter her home even without reasonable suspicion and search anywhere that a handgun could conceivably be stored.
Counsel, let's look at some of the cases. Okay, Griffin is a reasonable suspicion or reasonable grounds. The judge imposed it, and it was upheld, right?
My understanding, Griffin, it was the application of our administrative code,
okay,
and it was agents conducting a search pursuant to the code.
In Knight, there was a search by any officer in a probation condition without cause. But my understanding in that case, there was reasonable suspicion, and so the court left open the question of what happens when you don't have individualized suspicion, right? Okay. So this case does not fit neatly into Griffin or into Knight.
It does not, I agree.
It does not. Samson is the California statute, and the court upholds that. And then there have been many cases at the federal and state court level interpreting Samson. My understanding is that under those cases from other jurisdictions, this judicial condition would probably be upheld under Samson. Is that your understanding?
Yes, I think the majority of the cases give an overly broad reading to Samson. In my view, even a summary reading, a case that comes to my mind is United States versus Betts, a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals case, where it did strike me as almost a summary disposition. It was a federal district court judge ordering as a condition of federal extended supervision or their functional equivalent of it that the person be subject to suspicionless searches. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals almost dismissively said because a blanket requirement under the Fourth Amendment is legitimate, there's no room, quote-unquote, no room for even considering whether this judge abused his discretion. I think that is far too broad of a reading, and I know I'm in a minority in reading Samson that way, but I would just add that I think relatively recently in Arizona versus Gant, our United States Supreme Court made clear that for 28 years, the vast majority of courts were reading Belton versus New York far too broadly.
You think Samson's read too broadly? Okay. So you're relying on a too broad reading of Samson to uphold it. In Iowa, the Supreme Court held that under the Iowa Supreme Court, under the Constitution, this would be illegal. Are you relying on the Wisconsin Constitution?
I don't think I need to rely on the Wisconsin Constitution. However, if this court would come to the conclusion that this condition is permissible under the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, I would urge this court to evaluate this condition under Article 1, Section 11 of our state constitution. Going as far back as Hoyer, our state has interpreted the Fourth Amendment to provide greater protections to the individual citizen than does the United States Constitution. You
know. But you're really relying that Samson is an outlier based on the legislative enactment.
Yeah, I think Samson is an extreme case where the United States Supreme Court was faced with a situation of being asked to strike down a statute that the state of California had passed in order to supervise all of its parolees in that state's crisis situation. You see that the red light is on.
Thank you, counsel, unless there are further questions. All right, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Maura F.J. Whalen, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Ms. Whalen.
May it please the court. There's been discussion this morning about the possibility that the police will conduct suspicionless searches of Rowan in an unreasonable or harassing manner. I want to start with that. The short response to these speculations is that the circuit court specifically ordered that any suspicionless search of Rowan be conducted in a reasonable manner.
Well, would it be reasonable to search her in a restaurant, ask her to open her purse in a restaurant?
Just give me a second because I have sort of I want to frame the answer to that question.
Okay.
And then I will directly answer that question.
Appreciate that.
But because my longer but more fitting response is that harassing searches, and this is sort of suggested by Justice Crooks, the harassing searches predicted by Rowan have not yet occurred so that the issue is not ripe for review. Recall that in Knights and Sampson, both men had in fact been searched. So those cases didn't determine in the abstract whether suspicionless searches were constitutional. They determined that as applied to searches that actually occurred, the provisions were constitutional. So what we have here really is a facial challenge to this condition of extended supervision. And in the statutory context, a facial challenge requires a party to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that there are no possible applications or interpretations of the statute which would be constitutional. The challenge condition of supervision should be judged this same way. Is it possible for the police to execute a suspicionless search in a reasonable manner? Yes. Therefore, the condition survives a facial challenge.
Now let's look at... We're not dealing with a statute, are we?
No, we're not. But I'm saying that the analysis, since there has not yet been an application that we know of the condition, the suspicionless search condition, we need to analyze the condition itself on a facial basis.
Mm-hmm.
And in the future, if Ms. Rowan is subjected to a search that is in some way harassing, or actually any kind of search, she can go in and argue that it is unconstitutional, and that question will be answered based on the totality of the circumstances. In the restaurant hypothetical, a court would look at that situation and analyze her reasonable expectations of privacy and the governmental interest. And it would look to see whether the method of the search was reasonable, done in a reasonable manner. I think first the court would ask whether the search was justified at its inception, and I think you can just look at the search condition and say yes. And then the second question would be was the search actually conducted reasonably related to its objective? In the restaurant situation, I think that Chief Justice Yu, but it may have been someone else who suggested she could be asked to step outside. She could be asked to go into the bathroom, and the question would be whether it was reasonable to subject her to a search that was unnecessarily humiliating. I think that the kinds of
I understand that it's the state's position that this condition, that is, that the person is subject to search anytime, anywhere, mm-hmm. as long as it's reasonable, is a valid condition. So that's the state's position. Right. So that it's the state's position that the court authorizing law enforcement to enter the house without reasonable suspicion, mm-hmm. without a scintilla of suspicion, mm-hmm. is a valid condition.
It is the state. Yes, that is the state's
position. That's the state's position. On what do you base that?
Just to start from the beginning, I suppose, the touchstone of the Fourth Amendment is reasonableness, not individualized suspicion. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld suspicionless searches in a variety of circumstances, demonstrating that individualized suspicion is not a constitutional floor. Knights and Sampson teach us that the Fourth Amendment totality of the circumstances analysis is the tool to use.
Counsel, let me interrupt you. I keep going back to this framework, and that's, being a trial court judge. I sit in that seat, and people would come in, and maybe there'd be a drug charge or something because a probation agent went in their home and found some drugs, and then there'd be a new charge that would arise because of that search, mm-hmm. right? And they'd say, oh, the probation agent shouldn't have been in there. They didn't have my permission. Or they'd make the arguments as to why that should be suppressed. Those rights aren't eliminated because of this provision, are they?
The right to challenge the search?
Right.
Yes, exactly. They are not.
So what difference does it make that this is in this order, or if it wasn't in the order? Because you still have a reduced expectation of privacy as someone who is on extended supervision or probation. Your expectation is not the same as someone who has not been convicted and placed on that legal status. But you still have a certain expectation of privacy, and you have the right to challenge what has been done to you if you think that search or that procedure or that was wrong somehow, and then that evidence would be suppressed if it was not done correctly, and those charges couldn't go forward. So I guess my thought is, why does it make a difference? Because a judge can't eliminate your constitutional rights or your rights by putting something in an order, otherwise the order is invalid. But if the judge is merely restating what can be done anyway, because as a person on probation or extended supervision, you have a lesser expectation of privacy. I mean, they can call you in and make you give urine samples. You can't just do that to anyone sitting here in the audience. You have to have a reason for that. You're in a different status if you're on legal extended supervision or probation. So I guess I'm having a hard time getting by. What difference does it make? It doesn't eliminate the rights the person would otherwise have, because a judge can't do that through an order.
Well, the reason it makes a difference is that, as we know from Knights and Sampson, A, the very important point that you point out is that you can, regardless of this condition, statutory or otherwise, you get to come in and challenge the search. However, and Knights was especially explicit about this, when you are conducting the totality of circumstances balancing test, the fact that that condition is there is part of the balancing equation. And in what despite the fact that it's, for me, I find a somewhat circular argument, but the U.S. Supreme Court made it, that when the supervised person has been notified that they're going to be subject to suspicionless searches, that fact alone further reduces his expectation of privacy.
But an agent would do that anyway. When they sit down and go through, here are going to be the rules of your probation, here are the rules of your extended supervision, that's one of them, at least. That's my understanding. That's usually one. You know, you're going to be subject to different conditions, and here's what they are, and I can show up, and blah, blah, blah.
But I do think that even though supervised persons have reduced expectations of privacy, that the U.S. Supreme Court cases teach that still there has to be some explicit source of an officer's authority to conduct a search without a warrant, without probable cause. I mean, I think that if you didn't have any regulations, any conditions whatsoever, and I doubt that exists anywhere, but let's say that in the state of South Canada, there's nothing saying you can get even a urine analysis without a warrant based on probable cause. If there is no such regulation or condition of individual supervision, the officer would have to get a warrant based on probable cause. There has to be some authority. And so that's why it's important, because what we're talking about today...
Let's just clarify that.
Yeah.
If the judge did not have this condition in, a law enforcement officer could not stop her on the street without reasonable suspicion and check for a gun. Is that right?
I believe that's right.
A law enforcement officer could not enter her home without reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or exigent circumstances.
And a warrant, I mean, to enter.
Or a
warrant, yeah.
To look for a gun. So the thing that gives the law enforcement officer authority here to do any of those acts is the judge's order.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the question here is, did the judge have authority, constitutional authority, mm-hmm. to issue that kind of order? Because that order eliminates the Fourth Amendment protections for this person. Except as to reasonableness in execution. But reasonable in execution goes to warrants too, right?
Yeah.
So
and
that's
also
no
there would
change.
Be, I would just say, I agree with Mr. Lazat that when, you know, it's not can search for rifles, and so that when we're talking about small handguns, the police can't look at everything, but I don't know what the percentages are, maybe 97%.
Counsel?
But, yeah. Yes.
You can always challenge the reasonableness of the execution, mm-hmm. the methodology. That's what you're talking about. This case is a tough case, and it's certified to us by the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
And they say in the first paragraph of their certification, and I'm going to ask you if you agree with their statement, while it is clear that a court may impose conditions of extended supervision that limit a defendant's Fourth Amendment rights, the issue presented here is whether it is permissible to impose a condition that, in essence, eliminates those rights. And there are no Wisconsin cases that address this issue. Is that a correct statement of the issue? The issue presented here is whether it's permissible to impose a condition that, in essence, eliminates those rights?
Well, I think that I just have to condition that statement with maybe effectively eliminates those rights because of the size of a small handgun. That's the situation that we're talking about something small, so it can be hidden a lots and lots of places. I think that if the condition actually, rather than effectively, fully eliminated Fourth Amendment rights, I'm not sure, but it's hard to think of a condition that could say, well, you are you have no Fourth Amendment rights. You can be searched at any time for anything. Such a condition would have to be justified in the court sentencing remarks. The thing about this case and this specific condition is that it is, I think, very thoroughly and effectively justified.
So as long as it's individually tailored, I'll use language from a different standard, as long as it's individually tailored, it's okay to have a condition like this that, in essence or effectively, eliminates a defendant's Fourth Amendment constitutional rights as opposed to limit them.
Yeah.
Clearly, you can limit them.
Well, in my view, the individual tailoring is extremely important. And in that way, I think that Sampson, to me, is a far more extreme case than this because of the failure of individual tailoring.
Are you asking us to follow the Sampson? That's a carte blanche state statute.
Well, I'm not asking you to adopt Sampson because that goes beyond the parameters of this case, but I am asking you to conclude that based on Sampson, as Mr. Lazat criticized the Betts decision, I like the Betts decision that says if Sampson's okay, a fortiori, this case is okay.
Well, Sampson really opened, as long as there's some kind of a regulation, like DOC, I mean, to me, Sampson opens the door for unfettered searches, I mean, limitless searches.
Right, although the Sampson court said in response to Justice Stevens' dissent, hold on, we're not letting unfettered because it can't be arbitrary. Again, it's a reasonable suspicion.
But this is without reasonable suspicion.
No, I mean, but reasonable manner.
Yeah, method, yeah, the methodology.
Yeah.
That can always be the subject of challenge. You know,
yeah.
If they beat
yeah.
you up or if they're...
But I follow this line of questions. But I follow this line of questions with a bit different. Suppose the Department of Corrections drafted a rule that embodied this condition for all probationers and parolees. What would your position be then?
Well, the first thing I would note to you, Justice, and therefore the first thing I would turn to in my research is that I know that there are a lot of cases following and I think preceding Sampson where suspicionless searches were conducted pursuant to either statutorily or regulatorily existing codes of no suspicionless search needed. I would research and rely on the reasoning in those cases. It's my personal view that suspicionless searches just applied in a blanket manner are problematic. And so I'm not prepared to defend a suspicionless search under a future Wisconsin Administrative Code regulation. I mean, maybe with further thought I would find it defensible, but I do think that what we have here is so carefully thought out by the circuit court and individualized that to me is the most important part of the case. And I think I can't remember in the appellant's argument, somebody asked about what if this was implicit in the circuit court's thinking that, well, you know, if I can't, for some reason, give her the suspicionless search condition, I'm going to make her stay inside longer. And we can talk about whether was the court really thinking that, is it improper for us to post hoc impose that reasoning on the court. And I'm not sure about that. But what I do think is the court wanted to do, and something that I think is central to the truth in sentencing bifurcated sentence regime, is that the court gave her something like 14 months of initial confinement and 3 years of extended supervision. I infer that that extended supervision with the suspicionless search condition is, in fact, the most important part of the sentence. This court, with very good reason, is very afraid of what Tally Rowan is going to do someday if she doesn't learn how to calm down and not use guns. And this three-year period of supervision gives, let's just say, the government on the one hand and Tally Rowan this very long period in which she can learn how to control her behavior in the community, and the state can learn to feel comfortable that she can be trusted living in the community and not going around threatening to shoot people. And so that I think that this is, and that's one reason that conditions of extended supervision, I think, can be very broad, because they're about helping the community and the individual through this transitional period between full confinement and full liberty.
You are asked whether the Department of Corrections could adopt such a rule. What about the legislature? Suppose the legislature said, hey, on extended supervision, there's without suspicion, without reasonable grounds, any law enforcement officer can search the person anywhere, search premises, to find weapons and drugs, because this person's a seller and we just got to get rid of the drugs, right? Or maybe he's a user. We got to get rid of the drugs. So drugs, too, can be very small, or they can be very substantial, but small. So can the legislature do that?
Well, I think that in our system of government in Wisconsin, that I think that the legislature and the DOC would be equally able to do that, particularly since, I mean, this is a regulation that would be reviewed by the legislature if DOC did it. So I feel that I don't really see a difference in legal authority.
The legislature could, in your opinion, enact such a rule.
Yeah. I mean, I think that after even
without the empirical findings of Samson.
Oh yeah, that's
a slight problem.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I did feel, and I just in rereading my brief, I recall that I think that it is arguable, though not free from doubt, but I think it is certainly arguable that the empirical evidence was crucial in the Samson case, but that's because it was so extreme and non-individualized.
Recollection, and I can't remember if this was Samson, that they were ordered to release a lot of prisoners from their prison. And
actually, interestingly,
that before Samson, or after Samson?
Yeah, I think that was after Samson, actually. So that's a very good point, and I doubt that we'd be able to make the same showing in Wisconsin. But
may I ask, the chief often asks a question of how would you write the opinion? Would you write an opinion, assuming you prevail, and tie it to the defendant, or would you write it broadly, or how would you write it?
I would write it tied to this defendant. And so I would write it narrowly in that respect. I would be talking about this individual, but I would write it so that broadly enough so that a future circuit court could impose a similar condition if the circumstances of that in that future court warranted a similar condition. But I would certainly not, you know, do an opinion confined to the facts of this case.
Is there enough evidence against this defendant?
Could I just make one other comment in your previous condition and then talk about that? Because I am disturbed by something that I think that in our briefs we really don't answer. And that question is, does this condition apply to just law enforcement officers or law enforcement officers and probation parole officers? I confess I'm not really sure what they are called now. My assumption is that the condition only applies to law enforcement officers, and I think Mr. Lazat said he thinks it applies to everybody. The original condition previous to the post-conviction motion was written simply, defendant must consent to search. So that was pretty vague. After the lengthy post-conviction motion hearing, well, I mean not that lengthy, but detailed, the court used the word law enforcement officer. Now, I thought that law enforcement officer doesn't apply to supervising officers. I think that if this court upholds the condition, that it might make sense to remand to clarify that question. And of course, if the court, you know, if I lose, that I think is moot. But so I just wanted to add that to that's part, I would put that in the opinion that we should remand to say, unless the court is clear that law enforcement officer does or doesn't include. So,
wasn't there an amicus in this case? Yeah. Didn't they the amicus take the position that if the trial court were upheld, they don't want it to be upheld, that the law enforcement officer has to be aware that he has or she has this authority from the trial court? What do you think about that?
Well, that is, I think, again, an as-applied issue rather than a facial issue, but I will go forward and pretend a search has occurred. And it would seem to me, without researching it, it would seem to me that whether the search, a suspicionless search is reasonable would really depend on whether the law enforcement officer knew that this suspicionless search condition was out there. Because otherwise, I think the search wouldn't be reasonable from its inception. And so otherwise, it's sort of like just a get-out-of-jail-free card to a rogue officer deciding, oh, I see a person, I'm going to go search her. I'm not sure. I think that there has been law on this, but I don't know what it is.
Well, but usually there's the fiction that every officer knows what every other officer in that precinct knows. So, I mean, you know, it's a fiction, but it's one that the court has accepted. How does it make any sense to say that any law enforcement officer knows that this person's on paper and has this condition, and in a small community that may be well known, how does it make sense to say he/she law enforcement officer can search without suspicion, but that the parole officer who's intimately acquainted with this person, who supervises him, who has weekly, daily, monthly, whatever meetings, goes to the home X times or whatever, but they don't have suspicionless right to search. I mean, why does that make any sense?
I think this goes back to the remand suggestion.
I know that's what makes me suspicious of the remand suggestion.
What do you mean? Because
why does it make any sense to give this power to a law enforcement officer, not the parole agent?
I don't really see a reason for that distinction either.
And
I
think that the reasoning that underlies the condition for the suspicionless search for law enforcement officers applies with full force to suspicionless searches by POs. And, in fact, the reasoning reflects the reasoning in and the sort of common sense observations in Griffin. I mean, if she expects probable cause, if she expects reasonable suspicion, it'll be easier for her to get away with it. So I don't really see why the court limited it to law enforcement officers. It may have to do with this question that I don't know the answer to of numbers, like there are 20 cops and one PO or something like that in Pierce County. I mean, not in Pierce, you know, in the town that she lives in. I don't know. I think that a more sensible condition applies to everyone. I think maybe the court thought it couldn't extend it to POs. I just don't know why the court limited it to law enforcement officers.
My understanding was that when the DOC regulations were put into effect, which was a long time ago, and they've been amended since then, that the intent was to give the parole officer, probation officer, the maximum constitutional authority. For some reason, mm-hmm. That sticks in my mind, but I could be wrong, but there's something about the history of this. And they only gave him reasonable suspicion to enter a home. So what do you think about that? Are these regulations pre-Sampson?
Yes, they are. But I see my red light is on. So
maybe
after
respond.
I answer your question, if I've left Justice Prosser unanswered. But I don't know about that. I'm sure you're correct. However, at some point, the U.S. Supreme Court began allowing searches of a variety of kinds without even reasonable suspicion, and specifically has said that reasonable suspicion is not a constitutional floor. Or individualized suspicion is not a constitutional floor. And so therefore, I think that maybe the DOC regs were originally drafted with what was understood then to be maximal constitutional authority, but I think the Supreme Court has indicated that as long as you look at the whole picture, that maximal constitutional authority can be zero suspicion.
You should answer Justice Prosser's question.
I withdraw my question.
Oh, okay. I mean, it's in my brief.
Well, the question was, how would you write the opinion? And their answer is narrowly but broadly.
Yeah. No, he also asked about the sufficiency of the evidence on the battery, and I would just reiterate what's in my brief. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
A concern I have is if the condition as set forth is left in place, Ms. Rowan will face a scenario where a police officer can show up at her home at 2 a.m., knock on the door, request entrance, then conduct a pat-down search of her person, conduct a thorough search of her home, and then inform her that he's going out to the driveway and inspect her cars. Now, the judge did say that any search must be performed in a reasonable manner, and he specifically referred to tearing the place apart. But he also made clear that she's subject to these searches at any time. The concern I would have, if there's no contraband found, yes, she would have the recourse of going back to the circuit court judge and asking him to modify the condition of extended supervision, and he may then say, well, I'll exclude searches of the home between 12 a.m. and 2 a.m., but this could be a repeated venture. I do think in this state, the people of our state have expressed their opinion that at a minimum, there should be individualized, reasonable suspicion before any law enforcement officer would enter her home and conduct such a search.
Counsel, what's a court to do? You have here, apparently, a defendant who has threatened, the scope of persons that she threatened was quite extensive, says the circuit court judge. And there's an unusual level of risk to the public, and many of the threats involved firearms. And she threatened a judge, and there's a pattern of threatening behavior. You have someone who's a pattern of threatening behavior and talks about those threats being carried out with the use of the firearms. What's the judge to do?
Well, I think you should take those very seriously. Unfortunately, I think that type of behavior is not altogether atypical. For instance, in many drunk driving cases, we see cases where when the person's brought in for the forced blood draw, there's threats that everybody far and wide, the police officer bringing the drunk driver in, the nurse that's present. And in our state, with the hunting culture, many of these individuals possess guns. So I'm not entirely sure how the person arrested for drunk driving that possesses guns that makes similar threats to everybody involved in the drunk driving arrest would be distinguished. I would also have a concern about how far this condition could be extended to others. A judge in an urban setting where gun crimes are a problem, and a young man's been convicted of a drug offense or a gun offense, and finding this condition reasonable within that setting. Pull over the young men, search their cars, search the homes of their parents and where they live. I don't know how you would necessarily limit it if up north a person who commits burglaries. Well, we have a problem up here with the burglary of cabins and vacation homes and the storing of stolen property. That's what you did. I think you should be subject to suspicionless searches by law enforcement officers for stolen goods. I think this just opens up, allowing the judge to impose this type of condition just opens up tremendous opportunity for mischief. The position I'm taking on behalf of Ms. Rowan is not that she's entitled to conditions of supervision that are absolutely no more stringent than are set forth in the code, but I am obviously asking on her behalf that before law enforcement officers, including the general law enforcement officers, be permitted to enter her home, they have at least reasonable suspicion.
Well, would you be here if the judge said all law enforcement officers can search car, house, person, anywhere with reasonable suspicion, which drops it down from probable cause for a home, right?
Right.
You think that's constitutional? I know that's
that would pass constitutional muster, and one of the reasons I hesitated, Your Honor, was that was precisely what I was asking the circuit court judge to do.
Understand that.
And if he had done so, I and my client would have thought that was a reasonable outcome.
But another defense counsel might not.
Another defense counsel might not. I think that defense counsel may have a very, very tough battle given the Knight's decision, where in that case the judge ordered
suspicionless
searches and the detective did have reasonable suspicion.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to, on behalf of the court, thank Mr. Lizard and Ms. Whalen for excellent arguments and briefs on yet another issue of Fourth Amendment search and seizure. They come up in a whole variety of ways and pose a very interesting questions for the court and for the state and defendants. That concludes our argument in 10AP1398CR, State versus Tally Ann Rowan. The students should remain, if they can, to hear Justice Prosser, meet with Justice Prosser, and the court will reconvene at 1:30 for its third case today.